Welcome to You, Me, Empathy. Thank you for listening. We would like to remind you that this podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only, and is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Known as just a silly boy with a feely heart. Please consider supporting the show. Check us out on Patreon or simply leave a review on iTunes. Here's your host and creator of the show, Known Wells.
Hello, feely humans. Welcome to another episode of You, Me, Empathy. My name is Known Wells, and this is episode 104 with my guest, Rebecca Sofer. In this episode, we explore why we aren't, as humans, good at talking about death. Grief as a life experience, losing both of her parents. Rebecca lost both of her parents. And creating a safe space for others to talk openly about death, loss, and grief in the amazing community called Modern Loss that Rebecca created. And Rebecca also has a book of the same title called Modern Loss. And I'm doing a giveaway, so go over to Instagram at YouMeEmpathy to join the giveaway. And maybe you can win a hardcover copy of the book Modern Loss. Okay, in this episode, we talk a lot about Rebecca's experience losing her parents and learning about what grief is and how to process grief. It's such a unique thing for each of us, and just this beautiful community that Rebecca has created with others in Modern Loss. Before we get to the episode, though, I just wanted to say thank you for being here. Make sure to follow You, Me, Empathy on Instagram and Twitter at You, Me, Empathy. Make sure to join the giveaway for the book giveaway, Modern Loss book giveaway, over on Instagram at You, Me, Empathy. What else do I want to say? I guess I wanted to say that I've been struggling lately. My tum-tum is not great, and that has had an impact on my mental health. You know, I get frustrated with my body, as many of you can probably relate to. Those who experience chronic illness, chronic pain, it's all tied together, right? My stomach is tied to my mental health. It's all connected, and it's a good reminder for me to try to listen to my body. I was recently chatting with an upcoming guest on the show, Christy Harrison, about listening to our bodies, and I've been trying to do that more. And I would encourage you to do that as well. Our bodies keep the score, as our friend Bessie says, and they tell a story. We need to listen to them. Often we're forgetting about them. So, I've been experiencing that, and I just wanted to share that out of the blue. What else do I want to say? I guess what I wanted to say also is that the new project that I've been working on, in a couple of weeks, maybe less, I will be start teasing that out and actually sharing tangible things you can look at, feely humans, and start sort of following along in the lead up to the public launch of this new project. I want you to be a part of this because you are a part of this for me. You, Me, Empathy is a community, and this new project will be about all of us collaborating and doing and sort of growing in empathy and vulnerability together. So look out for that. Make sure to be following You, Me, Empathy on Instagram to be the first to know about that and join the launch team for this new project. I'm very excited about it. I've been working very hard. It's a lot of work. I've been overwhelmed mostly every day, but it's worth it, and I love it, and I can't wait to share it with you. Okay, let's get to the episode, shall we? Again, this is my chat with Rebecca Sofer on episode 104 about death, grief, and modern loss.
La 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 la, You. Me. Empathy.
Welcome to You, Me, Empathy, a podcast about exploring the struggles we face in our day-to-day lives as humans trying to get by on this wondrous and overwhelming pale blue dot. The intent of You, Me, Empathy is to talk openly, without judgment, about our mental health, our neuroses, our shared anxieties and worries, to create a dialogue that is vulnerable and deeply human and empathetic, and to share that dialogue with others to inspire emotional and cognitive collaboration and insight so we can, hand in hand, break down the stigma that make us feel shame and guilt for struggling, for feeling our feelings, for being feely humans. You, Me, Empathy is a safe, friendly space designed to inspire the beauty in each of us. Today, I am happy to rappel back down into the empathy cave with writer, mother, grief embracer, and CEO and co-founder of Modern Loss. It's Rebecca Sofer. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello, Noam. Thanks for inviting me on. It feels good to be in this little space with you today.
Oh, it feels good to have you. Thanks for joining me.
Thrilled to be here.
So, before we get into your story, Rebecca, let's have a little emotional check-in. How are you feeling today?
I'm feeling really good. I'm not going to lie. Well, I guess it's which level are you asking me? How am I, like, am I feeling good on like a global level? I'm feeling really shitty on a global level and on a political level. But
sure.
I think the irony is I feel like over the last couple of years on a personal level, so many people who I'm close with have had this weird contrast between their terrorized about the world and so distraught about it and involved and whatnot. And then on the personal level, things are weirdly going very well for them. So today in particular, personally, I'm great. It's also about perspective, which is something that I have learned the hard way.
Yeah.
To always like check against what it could be like. I had a very, very, very sick toddler last week and now he's all better. And you know, and I feel amazing. Like,
that's a huge,
you know,
victory.
I feel really good. It feels really good to not be really worried and petrified over 105 degree fever. And
wow.
It feels great to be just sitting here and talking to you and drinking my iced coffee. And these, you know, I'm sitting outside on my deck, so I'm feeling really good.
That's good. And I'm so glad to hear that the little one is feeling better. 105 degree fever.
Yes.
That's kind of at the top.
Yeah. Before you have kids, you know, like if you see 105, you're like, oh my God, like they must be dead. And you know, they could be, but I guess kids just get really high fevers and it's still very scary when the thermometer says something like that.
Yeah.
Because I think like you and I would probably not survive something like
right,
that. But,
right.
They're tough little packages, thank goodness.
They really are. It is like I always, the analogy I always use, I don't have kids. My wife and I have been trying for years and have yet to be successful. But the analogy I always like to use when it comes to kiddos is you know, you go to the beach, for instance, like in the sort of fall or times when it's a little cooler and kids are just jumping right into that water and it's cold, it's freezing.
Yeah.
And you don't see any adults out there.
Yep. Yep, that's pretty much my daily existence, which is mommy, get in. It's, you know, literal, like it's not even just a metaphor. Yeah, my 5-year-old just dove into an extremely chilly pool the other day, and so of course, like they basically call you out.
Right.
Yeah, like I'm gonna do this, what are you gonna be, a total what? So you just have to do it. So yeah, they make you be brave, you have no choice.
They're just shaming you, little shamers.
Yeah, it's one ongoing inadvertent unwitting shame fest on behalf of them to you.
That's
so yeah,
it,
you know, as I always say, it's a good thing they're adorable.
yeah seriously. Well, I'm happy to hear that things are going well today. That's great.
Yeah, thank you.
So on my end, I just wanted to give a little check-in. I recently, so I have, you know,
I don't need to get in the whole story, but Rebecca, I have, mm-hmm. I have a slew of sort of chronic health conditions. And one of those things is my stomach. I have, you know, issues with my stomach. I recently went to a naturopath because I was tired of just finding where I get to a point working with a specific sort of medical practitioner, and then they say, gosh, I'm sorry, we just can't help you. So I went to the naturopath to see, like, hey, you know, what can we do? Let's look at the big picture, see how all these things are working together. That's kind of the whole point of integrative medicine. And took a bunch of tests. We went over the tests this week, and apparently I have a bunch of things going on, in addition to like high bacteria and yeast and very low B12 and very low omega-3. I also have my testosterone is turning into estrogen because I have some sort of weird chemical thing going on. So I have very high levels of estrogen, which can lead to things like heart failure, which is scary. But I'm on a slew of supplements and this thing called Biocidin, which has been making me all fluey. It's like designed to kind of kill all the bad bacteria. So my body isn't feeling great, but I think the silver lining for me is that for the first time in a while, honestly, like I've had, at least like I have steps to take, you know, toward a thing, specific steps, which gives me some hope.
You have a little blueprint. It's nice when you finally have a tiny bit or a glimmer of a roadmap, right?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I'm feeling physically not 100%, but like emotionally and you know, a little better emotionally and certainly hopeful. So,
well, yeah. I am hopeful as well for you, and I hope you keep all of us posted.
Thanks, I appreciate it. Well, Rebecca, let's jump into your story. So you today you are the co-founder and CEO of this wonderful organization, Modern Loss. You have a book of the same name, but I want to kind of jump back in time a bit and get into your really the seminal moments that kind of speak to who you are today as a human living here on this pale blue dot. Can you give me a couple of moments that really kind of stick out as being, you know, important and memorable as part of your own sort of self-actualizing and kind of where you are today as a feely human?
Wow, that's a question that you don't get asked every Tuesday morning. You mean anytime at any time in my life?
Well, you know,
what I'm doing, why I'm doing what I'm doing now.
You could take it that way, or you could take it, you know, so like I know for me, to give you maybe some context, like starting this show was very important for me. And it was very important because I grew up with a father I was terrified of, and, you know, some seminal moments are experiences with him, right? That kind of spoke to me learning about my own sensitivities and learning about, like, I was a really sensitive kid dealing with depression, but I didn't know it then, and I only kind of in retrospect through therapy have learned about that, but also is this great superpower for me now. So like things like that would be a seminal moment, but obviously you have like two very, you know, obvious seminal moments in your life in regards to modern loss.
They are pretty obvious, but as they say, cliches are cliche for a reason.
Sure.
I think I have a lot of like big turning point moments in my life that aren't connected to somebody losing theirs. Mm-hmm. But of course, obviously for me, and maybe because your listeners don't know my story, I never thought I would be doing what I'm doing right now on a daily basis. I never in a million years thought that I would be running this Modern Loss entity. I would have probably very specifically chosen to not be connected to anything that smacked of grief or loss or death or mourning. Because why would I want to think about something like that? That's such a bummer. But as we all know, life has other plans in store for us. And no matter how much we plan, the universe just does whatever it's going to do as the world keeps on spinning. And what it did to me and my family was when I turned 30, my mom died in a car accident. And she died about 45 minutes after I saw her for the last time. We had been on a family camping trip. And in the upstate New York, in the Adirondacks, it's like this beautiful, beautiful area. It's still my favorite place on earth. And my parents dropped me off late one night in New York City, which is where I lived and where I continue to live. And 45 minutes later, I got a phone call that there was a terrible accident on the New Jersey Turnpike and that I needed to get down there as soon as possible, which is, if you can just put yourself in the position of a 30-year-old single woman living in Manhattan. And this was Labor Day night at almost midnight without a car, because why would you have a car in Manhattan? That was not easy, but luckily I had a, you know, and still have a insane best friend who insists on having a car and driving everywhere in New York and has very good parking karma. And she and her husband raced over, and we got to the hospital in the middle of New Jersey an hour later and found out that my mom had not survived. And I knew this the minute I got the phone call. And my dad had been in the car with her, and he did survive. He was lightly wounded, but on an emotional level, he watched the love of his life of 35 years lose hers in a pretty bad way. And you know, that was the beginning of my journey through this world of grief, this world of loss, this realization that grief is, and loss particularly, is a forever thing that is 24/7 for the rest of your life. That is not something that is over on the 366th day of your experience at 12:01 in the morning. That is something that, you know, most of the time you just have to put on your big girl or big boy pants and care for yourself and stand in your own story and know what is going to feed you as you move through the experience of it. Because it is a stigma in our culture. It's something that people overwhelmingly don't want to think about, and you can't blame them, but they overwhelmingly don't talk about it because we're not good at talking about it. And that's ridiculous, because it's truly the one thing in life that we all share, this is except for being born.
It's universal.
Is that we're going to be, you know, we're going to die too. And if we die, chances are someone is going to miss us, someone who loved us, someone for whom we were meaningful. And for me, it just happened a lot earlier than I thought it would happen. It happened a lot earlier. I wasn't like 8 years old, but when you're 30, it's a very, very weird period of time, because you're not a child, and you're not like 80. So you're not like surrounded by structures that are supposed to support you. When you're a kid, hopefully, chances are you have surviving people who are looking after you, who are concerned for you, guidance counselors, social workers, structures, right? Even the government, there's oversight, or there should be. When you're older, chances are you're at least surrounded by people who have been through the ringer, and it's just a thing, right?
Right.
It's eventually a thing, and it's not necessarily so stigmatized because, you know, everyone surrounding you has probably had a handful of losses by that point. When you're 30, you're in this period of your life where your main focus is to build your life. Your main focus is building, not losing. Your main focus is like building up that career and maybe finding a partner and getting a house, or at least, you know, something that you can live in permanently, and a dog or whatever it is, whatever have you. It's the acquisition part of life.
Right.
It's the amassing part of life. And so it's just this really weird stage during which you're going through profound loss at the same time, because people around you, nearly all of them, are focused on building, and you are too, but you're also navigating profound losing as well. And so to find people who are able to create the space to, you know, talk to you through your own, you know, about your own experiences, or check in with you in a way that isn't just, you know, cursory, It's really hard. It's hard to find a community. It's hard to find a community because also chances are you're working really long hours, as I was. I was actually a producer at the Colbert Report when my mom died. And that, you know, as many people know, was an amazing daily television show. So I was in the studio 5 days a week. We taped four nights a week. I had very long hours. Yeah. I was not able to go at 2 p.m. and see a grief counselor because that's just not that wasn't the pace of my workday. And grief counselors don't like working at 10 p.m. So it was really hard for me to create the space. And I had really great colleagues, but it was hard for them to like create the space to reach out to me because they were all focused on their deliverables during the workday. And so it was just this very, very tough period of time for me. And then nearly 4 years after that, my dad went on a trip with a woman who he had, you know, like a lady friend who he had had in his life for a couple of years. Just, you know, he was eking out some enjoyment after my mom's death. And he had a heart attack while they were traveling and didn't survive. So within the period of about 4 years, I lost the two most important people in my life. And I was 34. And it was just terrible. It was so lonely. It was maddening. It was like literally like insanity inducing. It was, you know, losing parent one is very, it's very surreal, but losing both when you realize that there's like nothing before you and nothing after you, because I hadn't had kids. I didn't have kids yet. Mm-hmm. And I'd only just gotten married like 2 seconds beforehand. Wow. I'd just gotten married. It's just a very weird existential place. And it was just a lot to absorb within 4 years of time, which when you're dealing with profound loss is a blip. So I would say that those are two pretty seminal moments in my life that led me to, I mean, there's no way that I would be doing what I'm doing now without those things happening. There's just no way. I just, you know, some people are born knowing that they want to work in, you know, something empathic, or they want to work in the medical field or the therapeutic field or whatever. I didn't. I really didn't. I wanted to be a political satire producer. I went to Columbia Journalism School, but that was not my path.
Right.
But the path that I ended up taking was one that allowed me to use the things that I do know how to do, but direct it toward a theme that I really got sick of being a stigma, which is this whole world of loss.
Yeah, I mean, wow. It's just, my heart goes out to you. That's brutal. It's like the most brutal experience one can imagine. You know, I'm sorry. I'm deeply sorry for your loss.
Thanks. It was shitty and it still is. It's still really shitty. It's, but it's shitty for everyone. Everyone has their hands. Everyone has their multiple hands that they're dealt, and this is part of mine. And it took a really, really long time to really be able to truly embrace the phrase, it is what it is. But I would say that moment, that's another seminal moment for me, which is really believing that like it kind of is what it is. So let's just play this hand. Let's stop going out of our way to lament what could have been or what might have been or what should have been, or, you know, and just play this hand.
Yeah. And, you know, it is hard to get there for all of us because we want to project, we want to control, we want to anticipate. And yeah, the truth is like, there's so much random happenstance in the world. It's too anxiety inducing to try to do that because it's just not gonna work. I wonder for you, Rebecca, like losing your mother at 30 and the next couple of, like, what did the next couple of years look like for you? Like, are you just sort of pouring yourself into work? Are you aware of your grieving? Like, what's going on there?
The next couple of years were really all over the place. I would say the first year was very muffled. It was very much shrouded in shock and, you know, a stunned state, you know, because also I lost her really suddenly. It wasn't like I lost a parent who had been ill. And I'm, by the way, that comes with its own torture. It comes with its own trauma of anticipatory grief and all that. There's nothing that is easier than the other, but it's different. And so for me, the difference was that I was expecting to see her fully healthy and on the dance floor, you know, doing the electric slide with me at my cousin's wedding in Philly 6 days after she dropped me off. Because why I have expected it. And instead, 6 days later, I had just put her in the ground. And I just, my head was spinning. I'm also an only child between my parents. So much fell onto my shoulders. It was just, you know, my dad was in shock. I was in shock. I was on autopilot for such a long time. Work was really great. I mean, I still to this day, the show is no longer on the air. Of course, Stephen is now the host of The Late Show, but I'm still very close with a lot of the people I worked with there. They showed up in a rented van to my mom's funeral in Philly. Who were really great. And, you know, when they had to show, like in that period of time when like you're supposed to show up for someone, you know, they showed up. But what was really hard was when that period of time ended where you're not supposed to show up for someone or there's no, Shiva to go do. It's more like, okay, well now it's just a Thursday at 4 p.m. and I'm having a shit day because I'm being triggered by something. And I'm at work. So, oh well, joke is on me. I have to just motor through. So I think it was more that, you know, after that, those first couple of weeks, and I didn't have any bereavement leave from work, but I was told take the time I needed. But of course, I didn't know what to do with myself because I was in shock. So I went back to work after 10 days. I immersed myself in it. I remember I even got promoted the first few months afterwards. I can't quite remember, but it was a competitive process. I had to pitch all these stories and I don't even know how I managed to do it, but I just did it. I immersed myself in it because I didn't want to think about anything else. I played violin for 16 years growing up, starting at the age of 5. I didn't listen to music for nearly the entire first year after my mom died. I couldn't handle listening to music. It was like an assault on my ears. It was too much sensory overload.
Was it because of a previous sort of joy attached you had to it? And you felt like you...
I love music. I mean, that sounds really bland, like a bland statement.
I love music.
I mean, yeah, I love music, but like, I love music, of course. Like, I love, it fills me. I love symphonic music. I love the Stones. I love every kind of music, you know, like, in fact, I think that one of my key missions in life is to teach my kids. I mean, now I'm very proud. My son knows Queen. He knows Tom Waits. He's only 5. So I feel like I have a big task. And so for me to put on a song or hear something on the radio and just turn it off because I can't, it's just too much for my brain. That was so intense for me. And then that made it even lonelier. It was like everything was shrouded in silence inside me. It was awful. I didn't really want to be alone a lot, but I didn't really want to be hanging out with people. And I know that sounds like a contradiction in terms, but you know, whenever the show would go on hiatus, which was every several weeks, we had about 11 weeks of hiatus every year, I would buy a plane ticket and I would leave New York because I didn't want to be there. I wanted to be somewhere not unfamiliar, but somewhere I didn't live. I wanted to be somewhere where I didn't have a daily routine so that it didn't seem familiar. I went all over the world. I went everywhere from South Africa to Venezuela, where I used to live right after college, to London, to Paris. I mean, I spent a lot of money.
That makes so much sense to me. Like just getting out of your day-to-day, you know, that makes sense to me.
I did. And so that was a lot of that first year. It was, you know, every night I'd come home from work later and I'd just go out for a drink. I didn't drink, I didn't have a substance problem, but I just didn't want to be at home alone in my quiet apartment. But I also didn't want to be necessarily talking to people, but I'd go hang out with friends and I just wanted to be in a group of people and not feel like there was any pressure on me to actually be an active member of that group.
I see.
But that took a toll, because toward the end of that first year, year and a half, I really burned out. I burned out because I was going all the time. I didn't create any space for myself just to be alone. And I hadn't really found the right grief support, because I wasn't really able to get it. I couldn't take that time during my workday. And then during the weekends, I would go to Philadelphia every weekend to look in on my dad, because I was so worried about him being alone. And so, you know, just imagine that pace, like, that many people have when they are taking care of a surviving parent or worried about them.
Yeah.
I worked Monday through Friday, and then Friday night I took an Amtrak down, and Sunday night I took them back up, and then rinse, repeat. So it was a lot. It was a lot. And then I just started getting really tired. I started fraying. I was also dealing with estate issues. I was dealing with new dynamics. My dad, you know, had this new companion. And I also had not really been diagnosed with the issue that I was ultimately had to deal with, which was PTSD from method of my mom's death.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. So, you know, that was, not my favorite time in life.
Well, it makes sense that it would be, I mean, considering your go, 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 and sort of, because you weren't, to your point, you weren't yet capable or knew that you needed it or something, you tell me, to create that space to grieve yet. Like, you weren't ready yet for that.
Yeah, it's true. It's almost like I wasn't ready. Because I will say that the second year was markedly more painful than the first year. The first year I was just escaping. I was numb. I was silent, you know, the no music. But then it's almost like I started hearing again. I started feeling again. I started tasting again. And it was all against this larger backdrop of, okay, life is kind of resuming, but it's in this world where my mom still isn't. Like, okay, the first year wasn't just this like quirk. She's actually not ever going to be here. Like, that first Thanksgiving wasn't a quirky thing where she was just, I could pretend she's on vacation. You know, this next Thanksgiving is like, oh, it's because she's dead. Right. I get it. There's never going to be any Thanksgivings. And then I met my husband, the man who would become my husband, about 10 or 11 months after my mom's death. And, you know, that was really hard for me, because he was this amazing person who I knew she would never meet, and I knew he would never meet her. And I'm very, very much my mother's daughter in so many ways. And it was just so hard for me to know that, you know, it just was what it was. But it was just a lot. That second year, whatever they say about, you know, a lot of people said this to me, and I still can't believe that they said this. A lot of people said that old, like, it takes a year line. It takes a year. It doesn't take a freaking year. I don't know who believes that. Like, I literally don't understand why people think that's a thing. But it doesn't take a year. It takes forever.
So they mean, is the implication that it takes a year to process grief?
Yeah. A lot of people say it takes a year to not. I think these are the same people that say that you get over it. You know, like that you get over your grief.
Yeah.
They use terminology like at least, which at is least, like my, one of my least favorite phrase. Like, don't ever start a sentence with that. When it comes to assuring somebody of their lot in life,
you got to learn how to validate,
you know,
each
at
other.
Least or, you know what you should do. Or just, you know, saying, I know how you feel. And then comparing it to something that is like an apple and an orange.
Yes.
So, you know, a lot of people did, they threw a lot of platitudes at me. And some of these were people who I really love. They're not assholes. They're just people who did not know how to have this conversation. They didn't have the language, because we don't do a good job
of
having this conversation. We just don't do a good job of, you know, my goal is to be able to like talk about grief in the same way in which we're talking about, oh my God, I don't even know. Like, oh, the show Killing Eve, which I'm like obsessed with now.
Oh, it's so good.
My God, is it not the best? I mean, although Fleabag is even, wow.
Even better.
I can't, like.
Phoebe Waller-Bridge is queen.
She's, She is queen. But you know, like, I want to be able to talk. And by the way, Fleabag, very much about grief. Best show about grief I've ever seen. Oh, yeah. But you know, I want to be able to talk about grief in the same way that I'm talking about Fleabag or about John Oliver or about, you know, like farm to table dinners, because it really shouldn't be this big a deal. It's not like when you talk about loss, you're always rending your, you know, you're not always like, you know, ripping your clothes and sobbing. Yep. Loss sometimes looks like a financial issue or a secret that you've uncovered or an intimacy thing.
Sitting in our pain.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes it doesn't even look like pain. Sometimes it just like, you know, like a credit thing where someone's calling you to get money for a payment that your dad was supposed to make on the Subaru and he didn't make it because he's dead.
Sure.
And now it's on you. Sometimes that's a, you know, and that's a loss thing. And it's like, we're not supposed to talk about this, and we have to. We have to as a survival mechanism, because we are very, very quickly losing a lot of common denominators in this country and in this world. And I think that grief is one of the only true shared experiences that we can use to pull each other in.
Hmm. How did you, Rebecca, get to a point where you can talk about grief openly in this way? Like when you met your husband, for instance, 10 or 11 months after your mother passed, like, what were you able to talk about her death, or were you not there yet?
I mean, I had a lot of trouble talking about this stuff for a long time, for a good more than even after I was married. I got married 2009 and the end of June. Actually, just had my 10th anniversary.
Oh, and
yeah, thanks. And even then, I had not even dealt with my PTSD, and she died in 2006. So it was just really crazy for me that it took a few years before. Sure, I was talking about my grief, but I was doing it in a way that I felt like I was doing it in like a broken record. Like I mm-hmm. wasn't having any resolution. And sure. When I say resolution, I don't mean closure, because that's a unicorn term. I mean resolution. I mean like not obsessing over the same exact thing all the time, not having the same nightmares all the time. Like I felt like the record kept skipping in some of these grief experiences, and I wasn't really moving beyond them. And I just, it really took me finding the right type of grief therapy to get me to a point where I could say, you know, okay, like this happened to me. This was terrible. But I can't have nightmares all the time about my mom's accident. And I can't, you know, obsess over these tiny things that I'm so upset about, because it's taking away the quality of my current life and the potential quality of my future. Cause I wanted to have kids. I wanted to have all these amazing things. And that's why Modern Loss was so important for me to launch, because it wasn't just the goal of sure, commiserating over grief, like whatever. Great. There's a lot of places where you can commiserate. It was also, and primarily, about resilience and about kind of creating a community that could prove to each other that we are very resilient, and that there is a lot of light along with the darkness, mm-hmm. that grief is the experience of loss is not just black and white. It is one huge varied shade of gray. And especially if you're younger, hopefully you have a lot of life left. And I needed to be assured that I did, and that I could live it well. And I didn't believe that I would for the first couple of years. And for me to have eventually that turning point where I met somebody who was a professional, and he had a vested interest in me living a great life, and, you know, just kind of like forming my team, and also getting to a point where I just got really tired of ignoring the topic of loss in conversation with my friends. It just got to be very tiring to put up a facade of being okay. It's just tiring. And so once I started actually talking about it more in a way that wasn't, you know, just like crying, it was like matter of fact, it felt like an emotional exhale. Mm. And if, oh, I get it. Like I can talk about this. And if I'm not making a big deal out of it, maybe someone else won't. And I felt much more kind of empowered when I stood in my own story. And that was, you know, partially from a group that like, you know, a very informal group that of friends who had met each other in New York City. We called ourselves Women with Dead Parents. And that is, it was like five or six women who had all lost a parent. And this was not a formal therapy group. It was like a dinner party. And we all decided to like have dinner and have wine at someone's apartment because we'd all lost a parent.
Yeah.
And when we started talking to each other, it was just amazing. And we just proved that when you feel like you have this thing, like every month we'd meet at someone's place and we knew we could talk about anything, any issue at all. And there was no judgment. Once you feel like you have that exhale, you want more of it. Mm-hmm. And then you want to show other people who are really struggling that if they can do it, they're going to exhale too. And they're going to be able to free up energy to do other things. And so one of the forces or inspirations for modern loss at a larger level. And modern loss, because I don't even know if I describe what it is we launched it in November 2013. I was 9 months pregnant, which is crazy, with my first child. And my co-founder, Gabby, was about 6 months pregnant with her second child. And it was initially an online publication that publishes personal essays, like literary nonfiction, people's pieces about a narrow focus, like a narrowly focused angle of their grief experience. Mm-hmm. Not death, not end of life, not about death stories, but about life stories, about what happens to the person left behind at any point in time. Very narrowly focused, very candid, very open, very body, very whatever it needs to be. You know, no platitudes, no judgments, you know, just realness. And we also have advice columns. We have an estate advice column that we just launched, a therapeutic advice column we just launched. We have different resource pieces, but mostly a communal project that is actually of very high quality. So it's not a dumping ground. It's not a listserv. It's not a blog where people can just publish whatever they want. It's a high quality publication because both of us are editors and publishers and writers.
Right.
So hearkening back to what I said earlier, with Modern Loss, I started doing what I knew how to do professionally, but working within the theme of what I knew there was a huge need, you know, for attention. I knew that there was a need to move the needle yeah. in this theme. That launched about 5.5 years ago. And since then, of course, as you mentioned, we had a book come out last year, which is, you know, overwhelmingly original content, for which Gabby and I both wrote extensively, which is something we don't do for the site. We really just run it, but this is not like the Rebecca and Gabby project. It's got everybody.
Yeah.
And we have do live storytelling events and just like so many other amazing things that have come out of this.
It's amazing. And I do want to explore that a bit more, but hearing you talk, Rebecca, and the thing that strikes me as quite stunning and beautiful is this idea that when we're not, as you put it, standing in our stories, when we're not looking at these parts of us, these traumas, these experiences, these things that impact our lives, we don't recognize or come to terms or reconcile with the fact that, okay, these things are now part of our being. These things are part of our identities. When we're able to do that, I know for me, you know, recognizing, you know, certain traumas in my past, once I was able to do that, oh my gosh, the floodgates, you know, I was able to just be myself. And it's such a beautiful moment. And I think for the listeners, you know, hold on to that because that's such a beautiful nugget. And remember that the experiences that we have are valid and real and they impact us. And so like it takes work to look at it. But like mm-hmm. once we're able to stand in our stories, as you put, it's such a empowering moment.
Oh yeah. I don't even want to intimate that it's not work to look to really get into it.
Not at all.
Torture. Are we allowed to curse on this?
Oh, fuck yeah. All language is valid.
It was fucking torture. I did EMDR, which is, mm-hmm. I feel like it's like much more accepted now than when I did it a few years ago. I actually have like friends who I've met just through like my kids' preschool who do practice EMDR. They're practitioners. And it was so hard. I dreaded going into every session. Mm. I felt like I was going to die because I had to really unpack the intense trauma of my mother's death and the method in which she died. But I had to do it because it was holding me prisoner. It was holding my REM sleep captive. Mm. It was holding my waking hours captive because I wasn't getting REM sleep. It was just really impacting. It was holding my body captive because grief really impacts your body in ways we actually have. A whole series on modernloss.com about, it's called Grief Bacon, which I love that title. And
grief,
it's
bacon?
Grief in the body. Yeah, grief bacon. So that comes from, that's a German term called Kummerspeck, because clearly they have a word for every single thing. And it means basically it's like grief fat. It's like, it literally means grief bacon, and it alludes to the weight that you put on when you're grief.
Have you read, I'm sure you've read it, The Body Keeps the Score?
Oh yeah. It's on my nightstand. Yeah. Oh. In fact, yeah. I think the author lives nearby me in the Berkshires here.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
Yeah. It's a very hard book to read.
It is.
But it is very, very, it's a very powerful book. I've been recommending it to everybody. And, you know, so it's like the body does keep the score, because this, I did very hard work and I am so proud of it because it took a lot of bravery for me to go into that session, you know, after work and then go home and have a glass of wine and my husband and talk about Tuesday night. And, you know, for anybody to do that work, it does take a lot of bravery, but it is worth it because the right type of help can do one. It can alter the course of your life, and it altered the course of mine because I needed to know that I had a good life that I could live. And if you had told me in those early days that I would be here years later and, you know, just really happy and legitimately feeling so fortunate about my existence, in addition to feeling like, you know, my hand was unfair because I'm human.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have believed you. I thought it was all going to shit.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, how could you not think that? I mean, it's, wow. Yeah, no, I hear you.
And but I wouldn't be thinking it, you know, if I hadn't been talking about it, if I hadn't started communicating, gotten the right help, I would still be thinking that, and maybe I would even be living that. And I you know, it really was about, you know, it wasn't just about formal therapy, because I think what Modern Loss does and why it's so powerful is we're a community. So we have this really big closed Facebook group, which is so terrific. And it's thousands of people all over the world who join. And it's just no holds barred communication about just the mess of loss. And it's everybody from, you know, my husband is literally just died yesterday. He was in hospice. You know, he's 32. He had brain cancer to, you know, posts about stillbirths or, you know, miscarriages or very, you know, like long parental illnesses or, you know, but it's really about everything under the sun. It's not just about like death. It's about all the things that you have to deal with thereafter. And that's why when people say, well, how do you work with death every day? I say, well, I really feel like I'm working with life every day because I'm working with the experience of the person left behind.
Yeah.
And can do so much to help each other, help pull each other through this mess and make it a richer, more rewarding life that we have left if we really do help each other, if we really do help each other by sharing our stories openly. And I think that when you share your story openly, it's a multifold impact. You have, you know, you feel cathartic. You feel like you're having a cathartic experience. You feel like, you know, someone's listening to you, which feels good. You feel like someone is bearing witness to your experience, and you're really pulling someone else out of their own isolation. Even if you don't know it, there's someone reading your piece or listening to your live story and thinking to themselves, oh shit, like, wait, I recognize a little bit of that in my own experience. Maybe I'm not crazy, or maybe I'm the only one going through it. And that is why, as silly and basic as it sounds, it is so much of this is about storytelling, about sharing our truths, about sharing our stories. And that's why when we publish people's pieces on Modern Locks, one of the requirements is you got to go there. You have to go there. We don't publish niceties on the site, because that's not what grief is. That's not what living with loss is. It's not nice. It's there's an underbelly, and we look at the underbelly of it all. And so that's what we see in this closed group, is people just amazing, pulling each other through this murky mess and laughing a lot as well. Because, you know, grief can be really freaking funny.
Well, life can be funny and absurd in the ways that are dark and sometimes light and can bring levity to, you know, just our day-to-day sort of existence.
It's true. I mean, as you just said, life is messy, death is messy, so why wouldn't grief be messy? I mean, and people always ask, you know, so we had one of my favorite pieces from the book is Grief Speak, and it's an illustrated, we have a lot of cartoons in our book. We actually have 50 or 60 cartoons. We hired this amazing guy, Peter Arkell. He does stuff for The New Yorker, for The New York Times, and he's just like this quirky Scotsman. He's amazing, based in Brooklyn. I really love his work. I admire him so much. And he really dug into the topic. I just, you know, maybe because he's Scottish, I don't know. He really got into it. And so his illustrations just enhanced every single piece, and they really show, book is in full color. Each essay has its own illustration, and it just enhances the copy of it. And so we also have a lot of standalone cartoons that have text in it. And one of them is called A Brief Guide to Grief Speak, which is terms that you probably won't hear in a clinical setting, but we think you should know anyway. And that ran in the New York Times the week or before the book came out as a full page excerpt in the Sunday Review, which was amazing. And it's really snarky, and it's funny. I mean, I thought it was funny. I wrote it with Gabby, and it's real. It's about the real experiences. So one of them was closure was the term. It's like a lexicon, and the definition was a word that people use who don't know what the fuck they're talking about, or a mythical term used by people who don't know what the fuck they're talking about. Uh-huh. And then another one was. Ambiguilt, which is, you know, when you're feeling a little ambivalent about the fact that somebody died, because maybe you had a complicated relationship with them, but then you feel overwhelmingly guilty because you're like, wait, I should be feeling real grief about this, but I'm also a little relieved.
My grief should look like someone else's grief or whatever.
Exactly. And like, let's be honest, that's a thing.
Yeah.
That's a real thing. And so we ran this, and I would say, they say, never look at the comments section. Well, of course I looked at the comments section, a human person. And so I looked, and maybe there were like 250 comments, and 230 of them were, wow, like, it's like speaking my language. Like, this is my experience. This is amazing. You know, maybe 20 of them were, who do these people think they are? They are so snarky. They are so rude. They are so disrespectful. What, the grief is not funny. You know, this is, they just have no respect for the dead or for the experience. And, you know, I respect if that's your take, but I also then think that you're not somebody who is part of the Modern Loss community, because our readership and our audience are full of people who want to approach this topic in a way that is no holds barred, that does allow for a lot of laughter, because you're human and you have to laugh. You can't just talk about it in a sanctimonious way in hushed tones, because that's just not life. And you know, it's not about, you know, the modernness is not about, are you 30 as opposed to 80? If you're 80 and you love this approach, then you're part of this community. And we have people, we have readers of all ages. Our primary audience is really in that staunch 20s to 40s group. But we have people, you know, we have a book contributor who's in her 70s who writes about sex, missing sex with her husband who died, and how, you know, it's called taboo times two, and how people just don't talk about it. Like, when you lose your husband in your 70s, people are always saying, oh, you must miss like holding hands at sunset. And she's like, yeah, I also miss like having wild sex with him, by the way, because that's also a thing. And so, you know, we really look at the underbelly of it all. And some of that is really funny. And, you know, people ask, what is the role of humor in grief? And I say, it's a huge one. For me, it's my sanity a lot of the times, because if I don't laugh, then, you know, the alternative is not pretty to me. But, you know, and a lot of people also ask when I do talks and book events, they say, well, when is it okay to laugh? And I always allude to that scene in Sex and the City, which you may or may not be a fan of, because you're
I've only seen a handful of episodes, so I'm not very familiar.
Okay. Here's like the Sex and the City movie, which as a good New Yorker, of course I saw, and Carrie Bradshaw, she gets stood up at the altar by Mr. Big, and she goes on her honeymoon anyway because her girlfriends take her, and she is grieving. She's grieving, not a death loss, but it's grief. And there's a scene where she looks at her best friend Miranda and she says, will I ever laugh again? And Miranda says yes, and Carrie says, when? And Miranda says, when something is really, really funny. And that's true. And like the when she laughed is actually like this disgusting, ludicrous, hilarious moment, like really gross. And it was legitimately funny. And so I always say, like, it's when something is really, really funny. And that could be when you're planning the funeral. It could be when you're lowering someone into the ground. It could be at the Shiva. It could be at work. It could be any time, because you're a human person and you have to.
Yeah. And I think it's important to remember that there are, it's okay to do whatever works for you in terms of your grief. There's no shoulds, and it is, to your point, it's all a little messy and human, and remember that like your grief may look differently than other griefs, you know, and that's okay too.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no, you know, like, there's no like one size fits all grief.
Nope.
I wish there were. It would be a lot easier. You just like get the roadmap, like, you know, you go to the funeral, or you'd like, you know, do whatever you have to do in those first days, and they'd give you the handbook.
But it wouldn't be as enriching as like human experience.
And I'm not trying to say that I'm all like zen, and I mean, I'm not. I'm like really pissed about this sometimes. I'm pissed that my kids are not going to meet my parents. I'm pissed that, they don't get to have grandparents on my end, because my parents would have made amazing grandparents. Mm. It's not fair. And I'm not saying that like as a woe is me. I'm saying that for any listeners who are feeling that it's not fair, because it's just not freaking fair.
Yeah,
it's not.
Absolutely.
But just like in improv, you know, it's like, yes, and yes, it's not fair. And it also is what it is. And what are we going to do about it? And, you know, so it's
and
like,
it's funny.
And it's funny.
And it's devastating.
And, you know, and it can be enriching. And you know, like, I'm so highly aware of death and the fact that we're not guaranteed 9 decades on Earth, that I really do think that it's brought a lot of depth to my life that I may or may not have had otherwise. I can't say, because I don't know, but I'm very emotionally present. For the most part, with my kids. I mean, when they're being like pains in my ass, yeah, take a breath. But I mean, I'm very, like, I'm very, very present with them. I know them, like, in a state, like, I really deeply know them, because I really want to. Because I'm aware that, hey, I'm their person, and my husband's there. That's what they got. Mm. They don't have my parents. Like, this is us. They don't have any siblings from me.
Yeah.
It's they have each other, they have us. And so I want to know them. I want them to know that they have their people, and that their people know them and love them and like them and appreciate them. And, you know, I certainly wouldn't have taken a work risk like this doing what I do here, now. And so, you know, it does bring richness. I have friendships that I would have never had if I hadn't lost one and then two parents. There's no way. And I made some of my best friends in life after I turned 30, which
Same.
Is great. You know, it's awesome. And it's really just because sometimes dead mom, I'm leading. I know you're in California, but have you heard of Kripalu?
Kripalu? No, I don't think so.
So Kripalu is, basically a huge, it's like the largest wellness center on the East Coast, and it's here in the Berkshires where I'm speaking to you from, Western Massachusetts in Lenox. And they have amazing programs there, like yoga retreats and writing and this and that. It's awesome. And last year I led the first Modern Loss retreat. And it was 3 days long and we sold out. We had more than 50 people. It was really amazing. And I'm about to do the second one the week after next. And this time it's four days, it's Sunday through Thursday, the 28th of July through August 1st. And I'm leading it with my friend Emily Rapp Black, who is a New York Times bestselling author. She's incredible. She lost her son Ronan to Tay-Sachs before his birthday. Wow. She lives out in Southern California. She's a genius writer. She's a badass woman. She's a spine of steel. And she's one of my best friends. And I did not know her 5 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's so much there in the whole identity and owning your story. And like, once we're able to do that, we're starting to be who we truly are. And once we're truly are and exploring that, like the opportunities for connection and seeing each other for who they are and allowing others to see us for who we are, like, is such a powerful connection point.
It is. It's like, you just get realer a lot more quickly when you feel like you're comfortable standing in your story. Yeah. One of my friends, Amanda Clayman, she's actually a financial therapist, which I didn't even know that was a thing you could do years ago. Yeah.
So people struggling with like budgeting and just financial distress.
That, but like, it's like, well, it's not even just that. It's like, well, what do you like? Why are your spending issues this way? It really, like, it's like a therapist who looks at like your relationship with money. And of course, clearly in loss, there is a huge money component because a lot of times people leave stuff behind. And I'm not talking always millions, but even $5,000 left behind when you're dealing with inheritance, when you're dealing with multiple personalities, that gets really complicated. And so I've really learned a lot about financial therapy. It's a really cool field. But she wrote this really great piece on Medium when she turned 40. And sorry, Amanda, if you're listening, but I don't remember the piece, but I remember the headline. And it was called, it just said 40: ain't nobody got time for that. And it was about how she hit 40 and she's like, fuck it. I'm doing me. I'm flying my flag. I don't have time for this anymore. And that's the way I feel. I'm like, you know what? Like, this is me. This is my life. I ain't nobody got time for that. I'm going to share my story. I'm not going to like overwhelm you with it, but I'm not going to not say that, hey, my mom died or she's dead, or like talk about aspects of loss in a way that, you know, I'm just not going to shy away from my story because that's doing a disservice to myself. It's doing a disservice to the memory of my parents and it's doing a disservice to our culture, because if I don't share my story and everybody else doesn't share their story, then no one else is going to be helped when they go through it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm so grateful that you are sharing your story and you have beautifully here. Let's start wrapping up. We always kind of wrap up the show, Rebecca, talking about empathy heroes. These are people in our lives who are just great empaths. Could be even characters from movies or books, quotes we love, writers we love. I'll go first to give you a moment to think about your empathy hero. I'm going to read a quote from Anne Lamott, who's a writer I love. She says, quote, "You will lose someone you can't live without, and your heart will be badly broken. And the bad news is that you never completely get over the loss of your beloved. But this is also the good news. They live forever in your broken heart that doesn't seal back up, and you come through. It's like having a broken leg that never heals perfectly, that still hurts when the weather gets cold, but you learn to dance with the limp."
Mm.
Isn't that great?
Anne.
God. Killing Anne. It again, Anne.
Literally always. Always. I mean, just God bless her. And she just got married for the first time.
Oh, wow. Very cool. Good for her.
I mean, like, not great, like the wedding. I wasn't invited, but I read about it. I read about it in the New York Times. She was in the vows column, and I was like, go, Anne.
Oh, nice.
Getting it all done. Who doesn't love a good Anne Lamott quote? I would say, and in fact, by the way, one of her books, Operating Instructions, someone gave that to me when I was pregnant with my son, and I devoured it. And it's all about the first year of life as a parent. And,
oh, wow.
You know, just it's amazing. She's just like Anne for everything, seriously. Only because it's at the top of my head and because we alluded to it, but also because I am talking everybody's ear off who will listen to me about it. But I think that Fleabag and the character of Fleabag and every character in there and every word written in this show is so amazing and has moved me and touched me in a way that I don't think any other artistic depiction of loss has. I don't want to give too much away, but I think it's very, you know, it's like this character Fleabag, she's British, written by Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who is just a freaking genius. Like, she's just a genius.
Concur.
Oh God. I mean, she's amazing. And she's like a kid. She's like 34. So she wrote this show basically single-handedly, and she stars as the character Fleabag, who is just in a tailspin because her mom, her person, has died. And the whole show, I mean, like this is a year of self-loathing. The whole first season is like all this, you know, self-destructive behavior that comes in the wake of her loss and in the depths of her grief. And she hurts people and she hurts herself and she's self-deprecating and she doesn't want to get too close, but she gets physically close. And, you know, it's just, I identified with so much of it. And there is this one line that I actually pulled and put on Instagram and like turned it into a little like meme. And she's talking to her best friend, Boo, who also died. And I won't give anything away beyond that, but it's just known at the beginning that she's dead. And it's a flashback of her talking to Boo. And she's saying, "I don't know what to do with it." And Boo says, "What?" And she said, I don't know where to put it. I don't know where to put all of the love that I had for her. Mm. And Boo says, "Well, give it to me. I'll take it." And Fleabag kind of laughs. And she's like, "No, really, I'll take it. It sounds lovely." And it's just, I think that moved me so, like, I could start crying just thinking about that moment because this is, you know, it sounds like a little platitude-y or cliche, but, you know, I keep reading, grief is love that doesn't know where to go anymore. And it is really true. You have to find where to redirect that love. And I think that some of that can be directed still toward that person, because I think a relationship doesn't end when someone dies. It's just a new version of it. It has to exist on a different plane.
Yeah.
But of course, some of that love does need to be directed for you, for your own, you know, just nourishment to, you know, something, maybe not always an inanimate object, but, you know, sure, like a person, a friend, a lover, a child, or a job, a hobby, a passion, something, or, you know, a cause. And it takes work to rechannel that. And it takes a lot of soul searching. And anybody who is brave enough to go through that journey is well deserving of having found the outlet for that love. And it's just, that was just a scene. It was like the most, it's just a perfect scene.
I remember that scene very well. And it's, listeners, if you haven't watched Fleabag, it's on Amazon Prime, I believe. And it's, the first two seasons are there. Hopefully there will be more.
I think that's it. I think it's just one, two, bam.
Those Brits and their short run TV series.
Like, perfect. Like the way, I won't, you know, but anyway, it was great.
So good.
And yeah, and the episodes are super short. They're like 22 minutes long. So you could theoretically, like if you apply yourself, you can watch all in like 2 days.
Well, that's a great empathy hero. I concur wholeheartedly. Well, Rebecca, where can people connect with you and learn more about Modern Loss and you know, join the Modern Loss group and all that stuff?
Sure. Well, we're on all the socials. We're on Twitter and Instagram at Modern Loss. I'm you know, also there at Rebecca Sofer. On Facebook, we are on Modern Loss on Facebook. And also, if you so desire, I highly encourage everybody to join our closed Facebook group. It's linked to our public one. Our public one is really just for publishing our pieces, sharing our pieces and different things we think are important, our events. You know, but our closed one is where, you know, we really get down and dirty. And if you really need some peer-to-peer support, it's just an amazing place. I've been really, really moved by how awesome people are. We are also have a newsletter that goes out. We don't spam you. It goes out like every month once. So you can sign up for that on our homepage. And our homepage is modernloss.com. We publish several times a week. And if you have a story that you feel like you want to write for us, our pitch specs are on our homepage as well in the share your story link. And we accept pitches. Although, you know, we prefer pitches to pre-written pieces because we're a very tiny, tiny entity. And yeah, and like that's pretty much where I'll be at Kripalu. I'm not sure when this is running, but I will be at Kripalu in Western Mass. July 28th to August 1st, leading a Modern Loss program. And then I do a lot of talks all over. So, and also, you know, last but not least, I would love if you would check out our book, of which I'm very proud. It's called Modern Loss, Candid Conversation About Grief, Beginner's Welcome. It's available wherever books are sold. We have contributors ranging from like the public and so amazingly awesome, like Amanda Palmer.
Oh, she's great.
I mean, amazing. Lucy Kalanithi, whose husband Paul wrote When Breath Becomes Air. Michael Greif, who was the original director of Rent and directed Dear Evan Hansen, which I'm sure, given what you do, you must know Dear Evan Hansen is all about mental health. To just people who have really amazing voices and compelling stories that we wanted to pull out. And so it's this, so many different types of loss, types of people are represented. I think people from five continents are represented in this book, and it's colorful and it's obnoxious and it's fun and it's counterintuitively funny. And it's meant to be picked up whenever you need it and put down on your coffee table whenever you don't need it. It's short pieces. And you know, it's designed visually in a way that like, we want that to be a metaphor for how you approach the conversation of loss. Like we want this to be a book that is cool looking enough that you leave on your coffee table and not shove under your bed. We don't want you to be embarrassed about this conversation.
Yeah. No, it sounds amazing. And I can't wait to read it myself. And I'll make sure to link all of that stuff in the show notes, listeners. Rebecca, thank you so much for being a guest on You, Me, Empathy. I really appreciate you.
Yeah, this was great. Thank you so much for the conversation. And I really hope that you start feeling better soon.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Listeners, as always, I'm here, you're here, we're here together on this wayward, overwhelming, awe-inspiring pale blue dot. We have each other. It's You, Me, Empathy. Oh,